Okay, welcome everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Fred Bruins. I coordinate rulemaking for the Workers' Compensation Division. We really appreciate your sharing of your time and your knowledge today. We rely on that. So for today's meeting, you should have an agenda. The agenda is posted to the Workers' Compensation Division's website. It's also available on a table in the back of this room if you're joining us in person. And if you're looking on our website, it's under wcd.oregon.gov, under Laws and Rules, and then Rule Hearings and Meetings. Just a word about advisory committees. They're very informal, and they're not like a public hearing where people formally testify. This is really a discussion. We have some department staff here today, and we're here primarily to listen to you so we can take the information away with us. But we are also here to answer your questions. If we can, we will do our best to answer the questions, and if we can't, we will get back to you. The one ground rule I'd like us to observe is to describe problems or obstacles in a way that doesn't identify any individuals or organizations, because those wouldn't be problems that we could solve here today, and it'll just improve the overall tenor of things. As we go along, please let us know about any fiscal impacts, costs, or benefits to you or the people that you represent so that we can provide our best estimate of those when we file proposed rules later with the Secretary of State. Similarly, we're now required to, when we file proposed rules, to make our best estimate of any impacts on how our rules affect racial equity in Oregon, again, positively or negatively. Sometimes we go in with the assumption that there can't be any impact, but that's just an assumption, and so we need to hear from you folks if you think any of the issues or potential rule changes that we'll discuss could have a disparate impact on any group. We will hear background noises in your workplace, even keyboarding. Please consider muting your PC or your phone as needed. But we do want to hear from you. Use the hands-up feature anytime you have something for us. But don't hesitate to speak up during any pause in the conversation, regardless, especially if you joined us by telephone. Introductions can be awkward, as no one on the Zoom connection or telephone will know when to speak. So I will call your names, and then if I miss you, you can let me know if you are, in fact, here. Elaine Schooler, Safe Corporation, are you with us?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, Elaine. Lisa McKean, Balance Staffing. Paloma Sparks, Oregon Business and Industry.
Hi.
Welcome. Kirsten Adams, Associated General Contractors. Dave Boyd, Associated Oregon Loggers.
I'm here.
Welcome, Dave. Faze Lomax, Sedgwick CMS.
Good morning.
Good morning. Amber McMurray, Multnomah County.
I'm here.
Welcome. Julie Riddle, The Hartford.
I'm here.
Welcome. Rose Etta Venetucci of the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, Local 28. Or is there anyone else here representing IATSE? Jennifer Flood, Ombuds for Oregon Workers. Dave Walkie, Small Business Ombudsman. Okay. Did I miss anyone from our stakeholders this morning who's with us? I think I know there's a few additional folks on with us. Dan Schmeling, you're here, right?
Yes, good morning, Fred.
Okay. Anyone else? And you're all welcome.
Sherry Flintstrom with Hoffman Construction.
Welcome, Sherry. Anyone else?
Diana Johnson from Gallagher Bassett.
Welcome, Diana. Anyone else?
Virginia Jones, Strategic Comp.
Welcome, Virginia.
Kevin Anderson, SBH Legal.
Welcome, Kevin.
Lynn Vu, City of Portland.
Welcome. Lynn, additional folks? Okay, then I'm going to run down the list of the people that I know are here from the Workers' Compensation Division or the larger Department of Consumer and Business Services, and then if I miss anyone, we'll just ask you to introduce yourselves. Matt West, Workers' Compensation Division.
Morning.
Welcome. Kirsten Schrock, Workers' Compensation Division, Appellate Review Unit Manager.
Good morning.
Good morning. Steve Passantino, again, Appellate Review Unit.
Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Jennifer Milliman, Appellate Review Unit.
Good morning.
Welcome, Jennifer. Yesenia Gonzalez of the Appellate Review Unit.
Good morning.
Welcome. Troy Painter of the Workers' Compensation Division. Catherine Hannell, Workers' Compensation Division. Kathy Ostern-Pontian, again, WCD.
Good morning.
Good morning, Kathy. Danica Karma, to my left, and she will not be visible on the laptop throughout our meeting because she's connected to our camera, but welcome, Danica. Don Gologli of Research.
Here, thank you.
Welcome, Don. And now, who did I miss? Okay, apparently no one. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and share my agenda in just a moment here. And again, I'll try to read enough about each issue, so if for any reason you don't have a copy of the agenda, I think we'll be just fine.
Someone has asked if you can speak up a little bit.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. I will try to do that. I'll bring the little microphone closer to me. Thank you so much. Okay, can everyone see the agenda now? Very good. Any questions before we begin the process? Otherwise, I'm just going to start with issue number one, but any questions about the process or anything at all before we start? Okay, again, this is very informal. Just interrupt at any time, and we'll do our best to see who might have their hand up, but the most important thing is that we hear from you, so please speak up. So our first issue, it looks fairly lengthy, but it's basically one theme, and that is we have temporary rules in place right now that you're aware of that are responsive to the Johnson V-Safe Supreme Court decision, and those rules are scheduled to expire on the 3rd of December. Temporary rules last 180 days maximum, and they need to be replaced by permanent replacement rules. We call them permanent. They're never really permanent, but they're actually promulgated through processes that involve public input, whereas a temporary rule is almost an emergency measure. But those will expire, and the rules will revert to their former wording if we do not adopt replacement rules by December 3. So the rules prior to temporary rulemaking provide for apportionment of permanent impairment and reduction of a work disability award by adjusting the worker's residual functional capacity when an outright denied condition, not a major contributing cause denied condition, and the accepted condition or sequela contribute to the impairment. This is inconsistent with Johnson, which requires a statutory exception allowing apportionment of impairment or reduction in work disability only in certain circumstances when the compensable injury materially contributes to the impairment. Also, rule language did not address entitlement to an award for permanent disability due entirely to a combined condition denied in its entirety, nor due in part to the accepted condition and sequela in combination with a combined condition denied in its entirety. Combined conditions can be denied in their entirety or as part of an accepted combined condition with major contributing cause denial. The rules must allow for both, as apportionment is appropriate for both types. A little background. On April 21, the Oregon Supreme Court published its decision in Johnson v. Safe. The facts of Johnson involved entitlement for a worker's permanent partial disability award when deemed to be due to a combination of factors, including contribution from the accepted condition, as well as an outright unrelated denied condition. the denied condition was not a major contributing cause denial as described in statute. The Supreme Court first determined the worker's accepted condition was a material contributing cause to the worker's permanent impairment. Further, the court determined that the Court of Appeals, which overturned the Appellate Review Unit's order and the Oregon Workers' Compensation Board hearing and board-level decisions, had correctly disallowed apportionment, a reduction in the worker's permanent disability benefits, deemed to be due to the worker's unrelated denied condition. The court determined that when a worker's accepted condition materially contributes to permanent disability, no apportionment of disability is allowed, regardless of an outright denied condition contribution to the disability, unless the insurer follows the statutory major contributing cause denial process involving claims with a pre-existing condition identified in workers' compensation statute sections 5 and 266. Following the issuance of this decision, the Workers' Compensation Division issued temporary rules effective June 7. The purpose of the temporary rules was to align the disability rating standards with the Oregon Supreme Court's decision. Again, these will expire on December 3. Temporary rules provide that once the accepted condition or sequela materially contribute to an impairment finding or reduction in the worker's work capacity, apportionment of impairment or adjustment in work disability, in this case residual functional capacity, for contribution from a denied condition is no longer allowed unless the denied condition is a combined condition denied for a major contributing cause or CSIS denial, or a combined condition denied in its entirety. Refer to the options listed under Rules 7, 12, and 13 below, which we're going to come to in just a moment. Temporary rule language also allows for reduction of disability benefits for combined condition denied in its entirety. If a worker has a combined condition denied in its entirety, the worker is not eligible for an award for permanent disability that is not due in any part to the accepted conditions and direct medical sequelae. And if the permanent disability is due in part to the accepted conditions and direct medical sequela, then the worker is not eligible for an award for the portion of the permanent disability due to the denied combined condition. And refer to the options under Rule 14 below. So the division needs to adopt permanent rules before they expire on December 3. And the rule language will be inconsistent with Johnson because it will revert to the former rule. So we're interested in hearing from stakeholders if temporary rule language should be adopted permanently or if there is a better way to incorporate the Johnson decision into the rules. So the options that we have listed in each case, one of the options for each of the four rules that are temporary right now is to adopt the temporary rule language as permanent. And we have shown the temporary rule amendments in each case in terms of marked up language. And we've listed them out. However, I want to point out something that's a little different about the options under Rule 14, which again include adopting the temporary rule language as permanent. But an alternative would be to delete Sections 2 and 3 of Rule 14 as redundant, as these are now addressed in the temporary and proposed final rules under Rule 7. This would require changing the header title to delete combined conditions, and Section 3 is shown below for reference. So Section 3 is right here, and it would be deleted in this if we went with this option. And Section 2 is described right here because it's part of the temporary rule wording. And again, one of the options we'd like feedback upon would be to update the rules to better incorporate the Johnson decision in any ways that the temporary rule wording fell short. Or we have another category here to collect any of your other thoughts that may be pertinent to this particular discussion. Fiscal impacts, again, we don't have data that would allow us to estimate the dollar impact of these changes. But we would welcome your input, especially in terms of any impacts on small businesses, because that's a priority. And again, we invite your input on any unequal impacts based on race or ethnicity. So with that, I'm just going to turn it over to all of you and ask if you have direction for us, advice on the accuracy, effectiveness in terms of reflecting the Supreme Court decision in terms of the rules that we adopted and are in place now, or if there's a better way to do it. And so that's what we'd like to hear from you. Feel free to speak up or raise your electronic hand. Again, nothing too formal. Maybe you could speak, do you think that the temporary rules that are in place now, are an appropriate reflection of the Supreme Court decision, an appropriate response to it, or again, if there's a better way? Well, the reason we provide a placeholder for other, there was one possible variation for Rule 14 in terms of eliminating some redundancy. But otherwise, the status quo is the temporary rule. And the point in terms of asking stakeholders to gather and give us feedback is to kind of let us know if that's where they want us to go. We don't want to assume that we should just adopt the temporary rule language. We want to know if, in fact, someone maybe would read the Supreme Court decision differently than we did and have a different interpretation on what it truly required an agency to do with its temporary rulemaking and ultimately its permanent rulemaking. So, again, we're just interested in hearing feedback, and then we can decide to possibly to change what we have now. Good question, though.
Dan has a question.
Oh, Dan Schmeling?
Fred, this is Dan Schmeling with Safe Corporation. Safe Corporation is comfortable with the temporary rules as written and is okay with adopting those as permanent.
Okay. Thank you for your input, Dan. Anyone else? Let's get a better view of the.
Yeah, there wasn't anyone else.
Okay. Well, with that, I'm going to move on. But again, if you have any afterthoughts, you want us to go back, just let me know if I ever move along too quickly, because we do have some new ground, beginning with issue number 2, and that involves the apportionment of irreversible findings. Examples of irreversible findings would be a laminectomy or a carpal bone fusion, but there are many. And that's reflected in some of the rules that are affected. For instance, the Rule 5, the definition rule, has a definition of irreversible findings, and it's quite a long list. Many of them are surgical, but it's quite a long list of irreversible findings, sometimes called hard findings. And also affected would be Rules 13, where we have a section on irreversible findings of impairment or surgical value, and also Rule 15, where we discuss offsets from a prior claim. So under the current rules, a worker with an irreversible finding of impairment due in material part to the accepted condition in sequela receives the full value awarded in the rules for the finding, and this may conflict with Johnson. For background, the rules currently do not allow apportionment of irreversible findings of permanent impairment, regardless of contribution from any other factors, including a denied combined condition. per the Supreme Court's decision in Johnson, if the compensable injury has a material contribution to impairment, the only available apportionment allowance is through a statutory exception, a combined condition denied for a major contributing cause or ceases denial, or a combined condition denied in its entirety. This implies that any impairment value, including irreversible findings, can be apportioned if it falls under a combined condition denial exception. This puts irreversible findings in possible direct conflict with Johnson. The division is interested in hearing from stakeholders if irreversible findings, which are considered a permanent loss of use or function of a body part or system, should be subject to apportionment as any other permanent impairment finding. And the options that we've presented are to allow for apportionment for all permanent impairment described in the rules, including irreversible findings, by removing the following from the rule. And then we listed out four places that would involve basically deletion, not really any amendment to the existing language, except just straight up deletion of those references to irreversible findings and how they're actually processed differently. And then we have an other as well to capture any additional information that you may have for us. So with that, I'll ask for your advice on irreversible findings and whether those could be, should be, apportioned to reflect the Johnson decision. Oh, Faze Lomax?
Good morning. I would agree that if the apportionment for the irreversible finding or the condition itself that led to that surgical intervention or the other irreversible finding is part of those combined condition processings, it should apply.
Thank you, Faze.
If we've denied the carpal condition that resulted in the fusion as part of that combined condition denial, we should not be paying for the impairment under that condition.
Thank you. Additional thoughts, advice from anyone?
They jumped to the front.
Okay. Please go ahead if there's anything you have for us.
Fine.
Go ahead. Oh, I thought someone wanted to speak. Jody, did you?
Yeah, well, this is Jody. I was trying to raise my hand, but I'm failing miserably at that. So, but I was just going to comment that at least in terms of Ms. Lomax's comments, you know, if they haven't paid for a surgery or that, I don't know that payment necessarily should be what dictates that. The same, because it doesn't indicate, paying for it doesn't indicate compensability either. But I'm not, I haven't really thought about that. And as most of you probably know, I was pretty involved in the Johnson case. But haven't thought about how that impacted surgical findings or other permanent findings. So I just haven't thought about that. So I'd at least like an opportunity to think about that more, but it certainly seems that if the injury itself is the material cause of the surgery, I'm not sure that we ever break that chain under the Johnson rationale.
Okay.
So could I clarify just a little? As an example, if we're going to look at like a carpal fusion, if we've processed the combined condition where we've accepted maybe a wrist sprain, that sprain combined with their person's pre-existing osteoarthritis, while all that processing was going on, they ended up having a fusion because of the arthritis, but there was at some point material cause for the combined condition. We've now issued our current condition denial. Under the current rules or the rules of the recent past, we more than likely would be compelled to pay for the irreversible findings of that carpal fusion while the claim was being processed prior to the current condition denial and combined condition processing. But with Johnson's findings, at least my reading of it would say that that should be looked at, and that those irreversible findings due to the combined condition denial, current condition denial, because they were a result of the arthritis, not the work injury in major part, should not be a PPD rating under the claim.
So you're saying that while you pay for the surgery, it's paid for as part of the combined condition, that the surgery, that the impairment, so
that is that the impairment from the carpal fusion that has been the irreversible finding, but that condition that led to that fusion was a combined condition, which we have now issued a major contributing cause denial for, because the original sprain is no longer major cause at the time of closure, that those findings that are a result from the denied arthritis and the surgery to treat that arthritis and to fuse the thing,
okay, well,
should
so
not be part of the claim.
Well, so I think that you're misunderstanding. So when you deny a combined condition, you're not denying, in your example, you haven't denied the osteoarthritis. You've only denied that they've stopped combining. And so this
and
is actually, Well, I'm going to let you, I've litigated that case. It's at the board. It's, the name of the case is Fred D. Harris. And so that case has been litigated. And even under before Johnson, that concept of irreversible finding, your analysis doesn't work because you aren't actually denying the osteoarthritis. And that's a major contributing cause standard, and the standard under Johnson is material cause. So just because you've issued a major contributing cause of the combined condition, that hasn't defeated the material relationship between the surgery that was performed and the resulting impairment from the fusion. That is one of the challenges, one of the large challenges of the Johnson and sort of say Robinette decisions, is that that there's one burden of proof for the combined condition cease denial, and then there's another burden of proof for impairment, and which is much lesser. So a cease denial does not then establish that there's no material relationship.
If I could, this is Jennifer Milliman from the Workers' Compensation Division. I just want to clarify, as I'm hearing it, there are two issues I believe the parties are discussing. One is whether the surgery is payable. This particular rule does not address or hope to speak in any way to whether or not the surgical procedure is payable. It would just be that if there is resulting permanent loss of use or function resulting from the surgical procedure itself, such as a laminectomy valued normally at 9% of the lumbar spine, if the injury was a material contributing cause of that, the worker would be entitled to the full value of 9% unless the insurer had issued a combined condition denial and the information, the preponderance of evidence establishes that that now denied combined condition is contributing to a portion of the surgical value. So the material standard would still be met for Robinette and Johnson. In the current rule, regardless of whether or not the attending physician was saying that the combined condition was a component towards that permanent loss of use or function, the worker would have received the full 9%. In a Robinette Johnson world, the department is questioning whether or not the rule would be conflicting with Johnson if there is a material component from the injury, but also a contribution from a now combined condition denial.
And I see Elaine Schuler has her hand up. Thank you. Thank you very much, Jennifer. Elaine.
Yes, hi, thank you, Fred. Elaine Spooler, speaking on behalf of Safe Corporation. We would agree with Ms. Lomax and Milliman's analysis of the issue here, in that Johnson did say, as long as the injury was a material cause of that, paramount is materially related, the worker gets the full value unless there's a combined condition denial. And then Robinette discussed that each individual impairment finding is looked at for that material relationship to determine whether it's related to the injury or not. And that seems to put at issue all impairment findings, including what we treated as non-apportioned findings pre-Johnson and Robinette, which are the irreversible findings. So now we need to look at each finding, and is there a combined condition, and the court, what the court has said to Johnson is, even if an underlying condition has been denied, which was the case in Johnson, if it's materially related, the impairment, and there's no combined condition, worker gets the full value. In our now post-Johnson and Robinette world, when that combined condition denial has in fact issued, apportionment of any impairment finding would be appropriate. The court did not put any limitations on that, and prior board decisions wouldn't be relevant. We would take the position on that piece, because the court's language, when taken together, applies to all impairment findings in a combined condition situation, and that would include irreversible findings, surgical values.
Thank you, Elaine.
Thank you.
Additional input, and I would like to say, Jody, you mentioned maybe needing a little more time to have a look at the issues. We typically provide a window of opportunity after this, these kinds of meetings. So if people have additional thoughts, they can send them in either in writing or just by calling them in. Just you can contact me either by email or by telephone, and we'll make sure, I'll make sure to kind of disseminate the information to staff here who are actually working on preparing proposed rules. So we will provide, you know, about a week or so after this for folks to give us additional thoughts.
Great, I appreciate that. And I really want to attend further in this meeting, but I have a Social Security hearing, an in-person hearing for my first in-person hearing today that I need to head out for. So I will come back later and listen to this recording, and I just didn't want you all to think I just spoke and hung up. So.
Okay, well, thank you for being here, Jody. Additional input?
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to actually move on to our next issue, but again, we can go back and discuss anything you want at any time. Issue number three involves presbycusis, or age-related hearing loss, reduction of a worker's hearing loss benefit due to age. This is a Rule 250 in Division 35. So the current rule allows for a reduction of hearing loss award for the portion of the loss due to the worker's age and may conflict with Johnson. Presbycusis, for background, presbycusis is the loss of hearing that gradually occurs in most people as they age. The rule allows for a reduction of the worker's award for hearing loss when the accepting condition and sequela materially contributes to the loss, as well as the worker's age. Per the Supreme Court's decision in Johnson, if the compensable injury has a material contribution to impairment, the only available apportionment is available through a statutory exception. A combined condition denied for a major contributing cause ceases denial, or a combined condition denied in its entirety. This implies that any impairment value, inclusive of hearing loss, can only be apportioned if it falls under a combined condition denial exception. And current rule language that allows for a reduction of the hearing loss findings if a portion of the loss is due to the worker's age, presbycusis, is possibly in conflict with Johnson and other cases. So the division is interested in hearing from you if a reduction for presbycusis is allowed. So one of the options is to disallow a reduction of hearing loss findings if a portion of the loss is due to the worker's age by removing subsection B that provides for a reduction of hearing loss benefits due to a worker's age. And there's a related age table that goes along with that. And as you know, as we age, the amount of deduction, so to speak, increases over time. And in terms of fiscal impacts, we don't have enough data to produce a reliable estimate of the possible impacts. However, we do know that very few cases are affected, just because one would need to be a fairly advanced age before it starts to come into effect. But there will be undoubtedly a small fiscal impact. But we invite invite your input again about the fiscal impacts and then any disparate effects on people due to race or ethnicity. Your thoughts about presbycusis and kind of removing the provision for that deduction from the Division 35 rules. Any concerns about doing that? Okay, well, hearing nothing, I'm going to actually move along to our housekeeping issues. Although housekeeping, but important, because we did adopt these kinds of changes elsewhere throughout Chapter 436. We held off on Division 35 just because we had rulemaking in progress and we didn't want to overly complicate the number of administrative orders that we had out there. But you can see four rules listed, basically Rule 230, 380, 385, and 390. And in each case, we have changed out the existing he or she, or in one case we had a S/he. We just changed those to either the worker or the person, or there in one case where it seemed to fit. So basically just removing the gender-specific pronouns from Division 35, as we did for, I think, eight other divisions in the chapter effective July 1. But again, we held up on this. But interested, if you have any thoughts on that or concerns, just let me know. Let us know. Sure, that's all I have. That's all we have on our agenda. But our agenda is what it is, and we sometimes don't know what else entirely, of course, related to the disability rating standards and hopefully related somewhat to the temporary rules and the Johnson decision. But do you have anything at all for us while we still have the opportunity to talk with you? Okay, I don't see any hands up, but so what I'd like to do is if you have additional thoughts about the agenda items that we talked about today, afterthoughts or thoughts that you weren't able to provide today, or you didn't think you were quite ready to provide them, please send us your input. I guess by the end of next week would be good. We're really good. That'll give you more than about a week and a half to get back to us. And we provide even a longer window, except that we're trying to get rules filed fairly timely. December 3 sounds like it's a long way off, but it's not so terribly far since we still have a public hearing that we will schedule in the future too. And there's some time frames that go along with that. So we're trying to actually move the rulemaking along fairly quickly, but we have a window of time where we would want to hear from you if you have any advice. So if you can get to us by the end of next week, Friday, I guess what day would that be? 9, or is it 10, 11, 19th? On the 19th, by the 19th, that would be wonderful. And or just to say, you can send it by email or just pick up the telephone. Anything at all before we close the meeting? Last thoughts? Okay. Well, thank you all again. Appreciate your time. It certainly went a lot faster than we allowed for. We allowed a three-hour slot of time. We'll give you back all of that time, but we appreciate the time that you gave to us this morning. It's not always easy. It's certainly not easy, and but it's much appreciated. We always appreciate your time. With that, good day, and have a good week. Goodbye.
Thank you.